Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the September 12, 2017 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, Claudia Arellanes, family business owner and treasurer of the Santa Ana Business Council, will take us behind the scenes and offer a long view of what makes downtown Santa Ana so vibrant. And speaking of scenes, playwright Rachel Bonds will talk about the wonders in her world premiere play, Curve of Departure, which will be performed at the Argyros stage at the South Coast Rep, September 24 through October 15 at Costa Mesa's Performing Arts Center. We'll be right back after a short station break. Welcome back to the show. My first guest is Claudia Arellanes, originally from Parral, Chihuahua, Mexico. Claudia graduated from an international business college in El Paso, Texas at 17. A day after graduating, Claudia married Arturo Arellanes. At the end of the same year, she started her own business making bedspreads and curtains. Claudia and her husband came to the U.S. in 1989 with their three children to open their store, Mega Furniture. Ever since, she has been serving her community as a merchant on La Cuarto in downtown Santa Ana, California. Enter the Santa Ana Business Council, which was established on February 2013 after a protracted battle with the city of Santa Ana to disestablish from the Property-Based Improvement District. PBID for short, a fight which merchants won and were granted in 2013. At the council's founding, Claudia became the first secretary treasurer of the new 501c6, which is one of the two downtown business improvement district groups in downtown Santa Ana. In 2014, Claudia fought with a large coalition to preserve the historic name of La Cuarto during the passage of the Economic Development Wellness Resolution. One of her first goals within the SABC, that's the Santa Ana Business Council for short, the SABC was to build a strong collaboration between the businesses and the school district. She has created enhanced programming throughout the downtown, training up to many burgeoning entrepreneurs. In addition to running a furniture store from Monday through Sunday, I don't see any days that are free after those days. Among other civic activities, Claudia participates on an advisory board to update the city's general plan, a document that hasn't been changed for over a generation. The Santa Ana Business Council, its successes and challenges are what we'll explore with Claudia today. She joins me in studio. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Claudia Arellanes.
Thank you for having me today.
Well, let's begin with how you first started your business in downtown 28 years ago. You left behind what kind of a life in Mexico to start a business from the ground up?
Well, it was a tough decision, but we were facing at that time in Mexico a big recession. And our kids were teenagers at that time, and we decided to give it a try in the United States. We came, we opened, we looked for a place, and we love Santa Ana. And at that time, it was the renovation of the downtown, and it was becoming the Latino shopping corridor. And when we saw that, we knew that that was where we wanted to be. We wanted to serve this community, and that's how we ended up in Calle Cuatro. After that, it was very difficult for us at the beginning, because what we brought from Mexico, it was our own manufacturing, because we were in the manufacturing furniture business. So we brought that kind of furniture. It was all wood, and we also brought pottery from different parts of Mexico, arts and crafts. And we noticed that our Latino community relate to that, but didn't want it to buy it. They wanted the new stuff, the shiny, the mirrors, the Panthers at the time. I remember the big clocks with a lot of mirrors and a lot of glitter, and that's what they wanted. So we had to reinvent ourselves on the merchandise that the Latino community was appealing to and they wanted to buy. So that was a very hard transition for us, but we made it. We knew that that's what where we wanted to be. And since then, we've been there. It's almost 30 years now.
Well, I want to find out, how you did you find Santa Ana? Were you driving up and along California or in the Southwest USA? Or how did you get to here?
Well, when we decided to come, my husband came first and did a survey. And he went from L.A. to Huntington Park to, I remember, even Dana Point, we consider Corona del Mar also was considered.
Wow.
And so it was all over. We didn't know where we were coming. And when he found Santa Ana, he called me up and I said, honey, this is what's going on in Santa Ana. The city just renovated the whole 4th Street. It's been into a complete renovation and new merchants are coming. They're from all over, Koreans, Mexicans, South Americans. I mean, and everybody is here to serve the Latino community. And I remember asking him, why do you say Latino?
Yeah.
That was my first, what am I? Am I going to be Latino? And then I heard something else like Hispanics. Are you Hispanic? Am I Hispanic? I didn't relate to that. I was Mexican, period.
Yeah.
No, so the first time that I knew that I was Hispanic and then I was a Latino was here when I arrived to California. So anyway, it was challenging, but it is worth it. It has been worth it.
Then at that time, that was the very, very beginning of the Artist's Village, very adjacent to Calle Cuarto?
No, it was later. It was probably 15 years later.
15 more? I thought yes. It was a little earlier than that. The first couple of galleries sneaking in or something like
no.
that. Okay.
Oh. No, not that I remember.
Not yet. Okay.
No.
So, and when did the Calle Cuarto, was that expression coined, or had it always been Calle Cuarto?
It has always been called Calle Cuatro by the locals.
Okay.
They call it Calle Cuatro. And when we started the Santa Ana Business Council, we wanted to get the schools involved because we were saying, how are we going to bring our community back? You know, so, well, let's start with the kids. The kids will bring the parents. So that's when we started working with the schools and providing space, open spaces for them. And at the time we were, as I said, when we opened up the association, we didn't even know what to do. It was, as you said before, after the pivot. And while working with them, one of the first goals was to get the schools involved. We wanted our community, we wanted the whole people to know. And that's when we learned that nobody knew what the downtown was.
Really?
When we were going to the school meetings and we said, tell me, raise your hand, how many of you know what the downtown, have you been in the downtown? Nobody will raise their hands. Oh, come on, don't tell me nobody's been in the downtown. Nobody will raise their hands. It's Calle Cuatro. Oh, Calle Cuatro. Yes, we've been on Calle Cuatro. We always shop on Calle Cuatro.
Wow.
So that was where we realized that they had no concept of downtown. It was Calle Cuatro.
Do you think it's also because there's the government center that people would call downtown? That might be, or that they're looking at Main Street all the way up toward 17th Street beyond where Bowers is or something like that?
Well,
they
definitely is the downtown.
Stretched. It's like nodes.
Yes, and definitely it is the downtown. But for the Latino community, it is Calle Cuatro.
Okay.
It's what it is.
Okay.
So that when the Wellness Resolution started, we fought for the name, to bring the name back. Not to change the name of the street.
No.
But to recognize it, as well as the Plaza Calle Cuatro.
Okay. Well, the demographics, you talked a little bit about the taste changing. And you've been watching the demographics changing over time, too. We'll talk about that because it's becoming more diverse as we visit now. So I would like for you, so people understand what other adjustments you had to make is that the financial services for your customers were not easy, did not come easy to them, to help them market with you. Could you talk to us about those barriers for them to be participants in the local economy?
Definitely. those early years, people did not have the resources or the, they were not able to have a bank account
right.
or the instruments. They were not able to have bank accounts. Our community did not have credit cards. So between jewelry stores and furniture stores, we were the ones opening up credit for our community. When we did that, we were encouraging people to take care of their credit
mm-hmm.
because they will have a better future because this was the way that things were done here. And you need to know that in Mexico, there was no credit available for the locals, you know.
But only, there are banks.
Yes. I mean, there's not. You pay cash.
Oh, okay.
You know, so especially in this immigrant Latino community. I'm not saying that all over Mexico. I'm just saying the immigrant Latino community, the people that were hurting the most
and
in
moving.
Our own country.
Their itinerant community.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm talking specifically about them, which were the merchants, I mean, the customers
yes.
that we had. So I guess between the furniture and the jewelry stores, we really changed a whole generation of the Latino community in towards credit.
And how did you do that?
By opening up their own first credit accounts, then banks started to buy from us bulk purchases of contracts. So when we did that, the bank, for instance, Wells Fargo used to buy bulk purchases from us. And it was an account for $1,000. So they immediately switched it to a credit card account. And they would hand over the customer a credit card for $1,500. So at that time, he already owed $1,000, which was the contract that we sold to the bank.
Right.
But right there in there, they had another $500. Of
debt.
Of credit that
they could use at their
likings.
Right.
It was scary because most of them were not prepared for that.
Right.
But eventually our community evolved to better grounds and better opportunities. And yes, many of them did not came back to 4th Street or Calle Cuatro because they had better opportunities, and that's what we came for.
You came to where you had a better opportunity.
Yes, opportunity. So people will move out of downtown Santa Ana. They will moving south to Laguna Hills, for instance, which it's a service community to serving the elder, and Laguna Niguel, and then to the hotels, the service industry. So people were moving out as well. From Santa Ana. As people were coming in, the ones that were already established and knew the ways that were moving out to have better opportunities for them and their kids, better schools.
Claudia, I'd like to know, you brought up enter Wells Fargo with some kind of leverage in households' expenditures, trying to bid up their spending and all that. So how were those households assisted in that additional easy money accessible to them? Were there merchants or were there business people in Calle Cuatro that helped those households understand that extra $500 is a debt that has to be paid? Or you saw some real financial collapses?
I don't think they did had the knowledge.
There must have been some crises then.
There was.
Some insolvent households.
Definitely. And in fact, when the boom of the housing, anybody could only raise their hand and say, I want a house, and it was given to them.
Okay.
So we also saw that it was, in our community, they were hit very hard. We had customers coming and saying, okay, we're buying everything new. We bought a house in Riverside, so we're moving. And okay, good luck, you know, how fortunate you are.
Okay.
What can we say? So then after 2 years, then they will come back and they say, we lost everything.
Well, Wells Fargo, they needed a shark on their logo. Well, for those of you who've just joined us, my guest is Claudia Arianes, owner of Mega Furniture Superstore and founding member and treasurer of the Santa Ana Business Council. And we're in Calle Cuatro. And it's a very, very vibrant community there. I want to know if, besides formulating this business council, could you reflect for us what are some accomplishments you're so proud of with the business district there? I mean, it's an enviable setting. I love it when I'm in there doing anything I do there.
Thank you. We do too. We live for that.
Yeah. Yes. You should all see her beaming right now. It's like, wow.
Well, first of all, is the partnership with the other BID organization.
Yes.
Very important that we made this happen. The BID organizations, we produce art walks and community festivals, sidewalk sales. We provide music and entertainment through the downtown and create weekly newsletters, host meetings, mixers, open forums, promote, we advocate for the local businesses to the city and county, and bridge new collaborations, as I said before, with Santa Ana Schools and other organizations, while keeping around 5,000 followers in our social media challenge. Now, when we first started the groups, we were not coordinating with each other. Today, our BID groups produce half of our programming and collaboration. Together, we bring back the 1933 Santa Ana Street Breakfast, where 1,600 community members were there present. We also produced the Santa Ana Media Summit, which was very important because we needed to change the narrative of Santa Ana, how the media was picking on us, you know, by having audience and putting the red note always instead of the good things that were happening.
Yes.
So we saw how the same unfortunate event, the way the media handled it, did a completely different impact on the whole downtown.
A distortion of what's
there. Distortion of what it is, yes. So we were asking them, okay, well, if there's crime, it's a big city. It is crime. There is crime. But there's crimes in other cities. So please, can you please the comparison so people will know what they're reading instead of just, you know, throwing rocks at Santa Ana because it's everybody wants to hear the or listen to the red notes in the news? So that was very important. And I remember this lady, Alejandra Molina from OC Register, she really wanted to sit down with us and learn from us what we thought about it. And she made it happen. She made a beautiful story at that time that went from gentrification to Calle Cuatro.
Okay.
That was the first beautiful piece that anybody, any news station, wrote about Santa Ana.
And the Voice of OC, I think, made a statement by locating right on Calle Cuatro.
Yes, they also got the whole picture.
They got the memo.
They keep
writing it from there as well.
Definitely.
So, and I think you must have been responsible for the media workshop last summer then, that we were, that's where I met you.
We were part of it, yes.
That's one of the many forums you're talking about. That was really quite a gathering there.
Yes.
It was really, 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 really lovely. Well, what is the goal here in terms of, I think you're living that diversification dream. I think some people were thinking, is this only the Latino corridor, shopping corridor, or is this a melting pot? What sorts of behind-the-scenes conversations can you help us out with are mediating these trends?
Definitely it is a melting pot, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful mosaic of colors, of people. We have to embrace people, no matter where they come from. We are all struggling to make a better living. I think we all have the same feelings. We want to be better. We will not. We don't want to lose hope, no matter what the circumstances are. And I think that's what Calle Cuatro or the Santa Ana downtown has become. And we are very happy to embrace everybody. And I think that is what it's becoming so vibrant. I think you feel it. You feel that everybody's welcome. And now that we have not only retail shops, that we also have entertainment venues and restaurants, I think we've gone from 8 restaurants to 42 in the last 3 years.
Really?
So it is a destination now. And in fact, we're just having this...
Coming
14, yes.
Oh, that's Thursday. Good timing. I thought we should talk about that. I'm glad you bring that up.
Yes.
Yeah, that was pretty fine last year. What annual one is this? Is this
I think we're on our third year.
Third annual. Okay.
Yes.
Oh, good. And just in time.
And it is becoming sensational.
we'll post this up here. So yes. All the way to Radio Nopale. So why don't you talk to us about what the artist village. So is there like an artist village kind of representative on the business council?
They are part of the group of the BID district, of course. And because of the programming that we're doing now, like we open up the art walk the first Saturday of every month. So we bring music, clowns, dancers, orchestras so people can dance. So we are trying very hard to reactivate the artist village. And it is becoming also a destination. I mean, it is beautiful. It is beautiful to walk in there. And when we knew that we were getting to where we wanted is when we started seeing families at 10 o'clock at night, complete families, even with a baby in a stroller. That's when we said, this is what we wanted. No, this is a family-oriented place. Anybody can come at any time of day or night, and they are safe. We're also part of a very strong, clean, and safe program.
You're a venue.
Yes.
It's a venue. It's
yes.
a destination,
yes.
as you
yes.
said.
We have our noses stuck on everything.
So let's put it up. The September 14th is Save Our San Anne, because, folks, there's for those of my listeners and friends that tuning in, that I know there still are barriers to doing things in Santa Ana. However, this Save Our San Anne would be something to do. Savor, taste it on with all your senses. That's Thursday. I thought it was a weekend part. It's now Thursday, September 14th, 5 to 9:30. So you can have your picnic at a multitude of different businesses. You buy script, and then the script gets you into different places, and includes a Frida Theater. I think so you can watch a movie with some of the script that you buy.
Yes, basically this is for the tasting of what the restaurants
yes
there are participating. So $10 buys you five tasting tickets, and you can go on.
That's
and on
a pretty
there's
good
there's
deal.
Maps where you buy the tickets. There's maps that can take you to all of the restaurants that are participating, so you can get a taste of what it is in Santa Ana.
Yes, it's lovely. Well, I want to get us keep us behind the scenes. Are there any initiatives you can scoop the voice of OC and talk to us about what's in the works in the future, or anything holiday related, something? I mean, we know about the Arts Walk is every first Saturday evening of the month, but maybe there's some special kinds of occasions that are in the works.
Well,
love to spring that on our listeners.
Early this year, we also had the first literature festival in Orange County. We had it there in the downtown. 16 venues participated. So people were all over the downtown, which is what we want. People walking around and feeling it. And we will be doing it next year as well. We will continue with the Media Summit, definitely. And we also doing the Spirit Awards, where we involve high schools, the dancing teams. We're doing a rooftop cinema. At the back of the Frida every month, the last Sunday of every month. And this year we will have it on the 24th, I believe.
Okay, September 24th.
And it will be Labyrinth, and it's free. It's completely free for the community. You bring your own chairs or blankets.
It's a duel with the opening night for my next guest on September 24th.
Nice.
So we can get it all in, everybody.
Nice. So we're trying to work. You said, what's in the future? We're trying to work again with the facade improvement. We'll see if we're able to get it.
That brings to mind, as we're wrapping this interview to a close, that where are the funds that underwrite some of these projects? There's the business district can still collect some kinds of tax increment or a fee increment from businesses. Where is the support coming from besides the California endowment?
I think the California endowment, it's involved on the cooperative development, which is one through
yes.
a resolution.
Uh-huh.
And I think they're also involved on the incubation of some other businesses.
Uh-huh.
And we are involved in the development of a small business, of We have the farmers market as well. And we also, I mean, like, for instance, the businesses of music, the rondalla, the musicians, the clowns, we see them as incubator businesses. And they have grown. Their businesses have grown just because of the exposure they have.
Right. And then they bring you business.
Yes.
And so it's sort of a
business. Yes.
Your incubating is promoting your own merchandise there.
Yes. I should mention that the UCI School of Law, they are an invaluable partner to us.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. We are very
business
grateful.
Law practices and all that?
Yes.
Okay. Any other? I mean, that's mainly it.
Yes. And they work very closely with us.
Okay. Cheers for them.
They keep us out of trouble.
a good thing with tighter margins that saves some money that could be used in reinvestment. Okay. Well, I really, it's lovely having you on. I was so glad to meet you at the media workshop. And I guess what's the long view you see for that gentrification, the phenomenon?
Well, that's a very tricky question.
Yes, that's why I asked it.
I think life is cyclical.
Yes.
And I don't even like to use the word gentrification. If we don't want to be displaced or gentrified, we need to adjust to times. Times, everything is cyclical. So we ourselves are the ones that displace ourselves if we don't put up with times or changes in shopping patterns, for instance.
Okay.
We need to it's easy to blame our failures on someone. It is very hard to accept them and say, okay, well, I'm getting old. For instance, in my case, I'm getting old. I'm getting tired. I don't know if I want to, go again full on when I was 35. So we need to accept our reality. And I think we need to give way to the new generations. I am very happy to see Latino-born and raised kids or young men that have their own businesses right now on the downtown. So that is amazing. So I don't see gentrification as many people see it. I see it as a cyclical. And education is, I really believe that education is the only thing that will prevent us from displacement or gentrification. If you are well prepared, you will not be displaced. How can we? This is a free country. This is the only country that we can say that.
Right. Well, we, all of us in the media, have a role also in the education process. It's profiles to raise, nuances of what communities are providing and the interactions that are taking place, promoting what's going on there. So we're all going to take responsibility. So the cyclical nature of business development in specific districts within our municipalities remain vibrant, and we can all benefit from that. So Claudia Arellanes, thank you so much for being on Ask a Leader today. It's been such a pleasure. Thanks for coming all the way down today.
Thank you, Claudia. Thank you very much.
My next guest in just a moment, that would be Rachel Bonds, and she's going to talk about Curve of Departure. It's a lovely play. We'll be right back. Stay with us. For staying tuned, that's Oscar Torres's The Dance of Leon and Frida. Welcome back to Ask a Leader. My next guest is playwright Rachel Bonds, here to talk about her play Curve of Departure, a world premiere commissioned by the South Coast Rep and has recently received the 2017 Edgerton Foundation New Play Award. Curve of Departure will be performed at the Argyro Stage September 24, October 15. And briefly about her past body of work, Rachel Bonds' plays have been developed or produced by South Coast Repertory, Manhattan Theater Club, McCarter Theater, Roundabout Underground, Atlanta Theater Company, New George's Ars Nova, Ensemble Studio Theater, EST, which might be referenced a little later, Space on Ryder Farm, Williamstown Theater Festival, Actors Theater of Louisville, Study Theater, Arden Theater Company, and New York Stage and Film. Her plays include award-winning 5 Mile Lake, which received its world premiere at South Coast Repertory, The Wolf Twins, At the Old Place, Swimmers, Michael and Edie, Winter Games, winner of the 2014 Heidemann Award, The Noise, and Anniversary, winner of the 2012 Samuel French Festival. Rachel Bonds is an alumna of EST's Youngblood, Arts Nova Playgroup, and New George's The Jammin', was the father of William Ralston Fell at the 2011 Suwannee Writers Conference. She was a member of Space on Ryder Farm's 2014 Working Farm Writers Group, and her current commissions include the Geffen Playhouse and MacArthur. She is a graduate of Brown University. When critics uttered that they are eager to see what else Bonds has up her sleeve, you know that we have a treat in our midst this fall. She comes to us today, I believe it's Costa Mesa, no?
Yes.
So I welcome Rachel Bonds to Ask a Leader. Well, congratulations on your premiere of Curve of Departure. It has a very current, a precious, relatable feel to it. And we're not going to have any spoiler alerts because I am not going to blow any surprises. We can get into like the pedestrian here part of the set in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It's exploring the landmine of overlapping relationships and circumstances all at a delicate moment. What brings them to why Santa Fe, New Mexico?
A lot of it had to do with the fact that I wanted all the characters to be in a place that was foreign to all of them.
Uh-huh.
So some of them are coming from Los Angeles, some of them are coming from the Midwest, and they're meeting in this sort of neutral place where none of them are quite comfortable. So that's why I set it there. Also, at one time in a very early draft, the Paul Simon song "Hearts and Bones" was part of the play at one time, and some of the lyrics the beginning of that song is about one and one half wandering Jews wandering through the mountains of New Mexico, and in the play there is a Jewish man and then his grandson who is half Jewish, and that was strangely influential when I was first writing the play. So that's also where the New Mexico comes from.
Well, using the music form theme, instead of then that kind of a folk ballad, but you give your characters, mainly the 80-year-old, you give him a couple of arias to present.
Yes.
So it's beautiful. Well, I want an in on those characters. Are any of them, there's just four folks,
mm-hmm.
are any of them based on relations of your own or your own friends?
Sure. I mean, all of them are somehow coming from my life in some way. I would say Rudy, the character who's in his 80s, is a combination of both my grandfather and my dad. So he's sort of a combination of those two people in my life. And then, you know, the mother character is probably drawn from my mother and also from me. They're all from me in some way or other. But especially the Rudy character comes directly from, I'd say, those two men in my life.
Well, he does feel very, very fleshed out, as does Lucy, his daughter-in-law. So it certainly indicates, it's strongly suggestive of a pretty intimate relationship. And I want to say you captured, Rachel, dead on, that intermittent clarity someone with dementia has. It was amazing.
Thank you. That's so nice to hear.
Well done. Yeah. So is your father still living?
He's not.
He's not.
Yeah, so, he passed away in 2003.
Okay. Well, I didn't know I'd go there, but it informs again.
He's very present in all of my plays, I would say.
Wow.
He's a haunting presence for me, I would say.
And Lucy, his daughter-in-law, has a real...
Linda.
Why do I... Linda? Oh, did it change? I think I've got an older...
Always Linda.
No, yeah. That's my dementia showing. Okay. All right, we'll move on.
No problem.
But Linda's also very, very fleshed out, and it's quite a remarkable dance there that they, both of them, the daughter-in-law, and they're there
Thank
because
you.
they're... her former husband and his son had died. And there. So your convincing characterizations go well beyond, you know, the setting. How did you arrive? I'm going to try to figure how to put this. You go from the very relatable kind of local, micro-local, to some really broad concepts. I mean, it's a big arc from what's happening in those delicate interactions to what Rudy's got to tell us about the big things out there. How did you manage those two?
I mean, I never set out when I'm writing a play, I never set out to sort of deal with the big concepts. I always start small. My way in is always through the small little human interactions, the little day-to-day interactions that we have with each other. And then I just trust that the larger themes are behind everything, which they always, you know, I don't really know what the play is about usually until I finish a first draft, and then I go through and it's somehow become clear. But my way in is always through those little things, and then the bigger things kind of show up on their own. I guess I write a lot about, you know, small human moments that have really large reverberations.
Okay. That shows.
Yeah.
So when you're, and I go to the specific, but I want to do the general, how it's generally managed. But so when Rudy is going to be sharing those really utter moments of utter clarity, is he going to just really like hunker down, slow down, so that we get to take in every single word in the actual performance of his role?
No. I mean, everything.
Just clips right along.
We're keeping it at quite a pace, and it's all very messy as the way that, you know, human interactions are. You know, there's not a lot of time to slow down and really think about the meaning of anything.
Wow.
Until after the fact. So I think, you know, we're keeping it going at a pace that feels very realistic, and, you know, things are just falling apart left and right, and it takes a while for the characters to gather up what they're learning along the way.
And as you say, well, with this feel that amidst that, intimacy is a very rich element in your play. It's processed so effectively. It's sort of receding and surging between the characters, I guess. So that's what you're saying, is that we'll feel that in that, not haphazard, but in its sloppy, emotional, human way.
Yeah, sort of messy human way. Absolutely. Absolutely.
For those of you who've just tuned in, you're listening to Ask a Leader on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is playwright Rachel Bonds, whose play Curve of Departure will be performed at the R. Gerald's stage at the South Coast Rep. Mike Donahue is the director. So tell us about working with the director, what it's like you as a playwright with a world premiere. How much is going on between the two of you this week?
A lot. Well, first of all, we collaborate a lot. So this is our third production together. We have a very strong working vocabulary. We have kind of shorthand with each other at this point because we work very closely together quite often. So, you know, we've been involved with each other since I wrote the first draft and we started developing the script. And then he and I worked on casting together. He's very involved I'm doing rewriting on my own, but he's very involved in, we discuss things almost every day, and we work very closely together, and I speak a lot in the rehearsal room. I'm often changing the script as we go throughout rehearsals, so I'm very vocal, and he's very comfortable with that. Yeah, it's a very active collaboration.
And so that's something I did note in preparation that you had worked with him with the 5 Mile Lake. Was that one of them?
We worked
Wolf Twins.
Together.
Wolf Twins.
He directed my play Wolf Twins in D.C., and then he directed my play Swimmers in Marin County last year.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, welcome back to Orange County from Marin.
Thank you.
Two slices. Well, and also, this is an opportunity for you to, I guess, collaborate, too, with the casting. Why don't you talk to us, Kim Staunton?
Yeah.
Alan Miller, Larry Powell, and Christian Barillas. I don't know how to pronounce it. Barillas. So yes. What's that collaboration like for you and them?
Well, I'm in rehearsal almost every day, so we are very intimately involved. We talk a lot. You know, the first week of rehearsal, we do something called table work, where we don't even get up on our feet. We sit around the table and just hash through the script, do scene analysis, that kind of thing. And I'm there largely as a resource for them because I know the play the best at that point. And they, you know, they can ask me questions about their characters and any backstory that I've developed in my head, and I can help them with that. And, you know, I'm not giving them notes on their acting. That's Mike's job. But I'm there in rehearsal to answer any questions that come up about the characters and their motivations. So we talk a lot. I'm very involved in their process, too. And that's one of my favorite parts of doing a new play is spending so much time working with the actors. It's one of the most enjoyable parts to me.
And they're veteran actors. They've worked with the playwrights, of course. They must have that in their repertoire.
Yeah.
Okay. So yes. There are, as I said, it starts on September 24th, and I know you're listening in on the other interview. It isn't a dueling. September 14th and 24th are spread there. So how about, will you be around for any of the post-show discussion nights? There's October 3rd or October 4th.
I will not. So we open the 29th, and then I head back to New York on the 30th. I will be there for all the previews, so I'll be there the night of the 24th through the 28th. I don't believe there's any discussions planned for those nights, but I will be around.
You'll be around? Okay.
I will. I will be in the lobby.
We like that. Well, there's going to be then, as I said, those post-discussion nights, the 3rd and the 4th, and I know that people that are affiliated with the project do... they tend to linger. Not, I don't know, maybe it's musicians with attitudes that always escape and we don't get to talk to them at all. So then what are some other elements that I'd like you to tell us let's talk about the venue. You've been to the Argyro stage before.
That's where 5 Mile Lake was produced.
That's right. And so what do you envision the members of the audience are going to be able to do to heighten the love, the tension, and the curiosity sort of interacting in the play? Or is it going to complicate things?
Well, the play takes place in a hotel room, and it's a very small hotel room, which sort of adds to the claustrophobia of the play. And that was on purpose. I wanted sort of a small, compressed space where all of these events would unfold. And the stage, that theater it's one of my favorite theaters. It's a beautiful theater.
Yes.
But it feels sort of airy and big. And so in order to kind of help the play feel a little more compressed, the set designer, who's really smart, and pulled everything very far downstage. So I think the audience will feel very much more a part of the action.
Good.
And having them there so close will also add to that compressed feeling. I think it will really help with that sense of claustrophobia. And I think that the audience will, because we've pulled the action so far downstage, will feel intimately involved with the characters, which feels necessary for this kind of play.
So people, it'll feel like there's even more people in that motel room.
I think so.
Because I guess... you as a playwright must know this, what the actors, where they get all those cues from the audience when they're that close. There's gasps and chortles and all those kinds of things. So,
yeah, I mean, there's things we won't know about the play until the audience shows up. We just won't know. So that's that week of previews is when I learn the most.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, now you're working on this play. Do you already have another play in your head? How does that work? Is it like an airport and there's all these plays stacking up ready to land?
That's a wonderful metaphor. Yes. So I recently had a baby.
Congratulations, Rachel.
Thank you. So I've been lucky enough to have some productions in the works, and I've been working on productions. I have not started a new play since I gave birth. but I am due to write something for both the Geffen in LA and the McCarter in Princeton. So I have two plays that are kind of swimming around in my head, and it's about time for me to start putting them down on paper.
They're in the amnio fluid.
Thing.
Yes.
And also, we're doing this very same play, Curve of Departure, in Washington, D.C. in December, also directed by Mike Donahue. So that's happening almost right after this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can recommend that to those that are over there. It's on
their
way. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there was one particular thing I was going to talk about if we had a little bit of time. We have that, I believe. It's as a quick aside, there was this academic, his name's Steven Levinson. He's the director of the Max Planck Institute for, and nobody knows where I'm going to go with this. You may. Institute for Psycholinguistics. He spoke at the Distinctive Voices series at the Beckman Center last week at UCI.
Oh, wow.
And so what he discovered with this, like, full-on, global, multi-ethnic, meaning ethnicities that are, like, on the verge of disappearing, face off the face of the earth, there is a multicultural shared practice of how a person, the exchange and communication, he said, never mind, you know, music, drums, all never mind everything else, but just the exchange of utterances between the two parties. And I say that because it's the way your play is written, it exactly demonstrates that. But the fact that it was a universal thing that 2/3 of the way of a, let's say, a full utterance from somebody, 2/3 of the way the receiver knows what's going to be that latter third. So they already know. And that's where the interval of time between the first utterance and then the response is very short. So it's you, and you captured it. But I thought that was really phenomenal.
That's so interesting.
It's such a persistent cultural phenomenon, no matter where you are in Manhattan or New Guinea, you know?
I think it's because our brains are working so quickly.
Yes.
More quickly than our mouths do.
Right. And there's a pattern, though. I mean, there's so much ingrained pattern of speaking and cultural references and that kind of thing. So everybody knows it's like we've already built in a lot of redundancy in what we're saying. So you probably know what I'm going to say next at the end of my expression. But I thought that was really quite interesting.
Yeah,
and
so
the way
interesting.
Your play does that. They are overlapping with each other. And maybe that's also to bring that claustrophobia tighter inside the motel room. It's a motel. It's not a hotel.
Yeah, it's more of a motel.
Yeah.
You are right.
Okay. Well, Rachel, it's been a real pleasure having you on. Thanks for taking the time, because I know there's so many requests they have the actors to bring up some more. Are they already awakened at the theater now?
They start at noon today, so.
Okay. So
I imagine they're awake, but who knows?
Who knows? Okay. Well, my guest was Rachel Bond. She's the playwright of the world premiere Curve of Departure, appearing at the Argyro stage at South Coast Rep. That is coming up on September 24th, running to October 15th. Thanks for being on Ask a Leader today.
My pleasure.
Well, I'm going to give a little announcement. We've got some news here about tonight, this afternoon, at the Irvine City Council Chamber. The Community Choice Energy item is listed in the council's consent calendar. Community Choice Energy is a new way to get cleaner electricity to local homes and businesses and provide greater local control over the electricity sourced. And so that local option we've covered before on Ask a Leader with a couple guests. A good time to show up is about by 4:30. The consent item means that the city manager is projecting that will pass without a public discussion. It's not clear whether any city council member will pull the item from the calendar, so watch for that discussion. Well, next week we're going to have on the show UCI faculty member Rebecca Tuhus Dobrow with her new book out entitled Personal Stereo. It's the Walkman as the route to our social shortcomings. Ha ha. Talk with you next week. Thanks, everybody, for listening.